Hello, good morning and welcome to Money Talk from Channel Radio. We're live. It's noon on Friday the 18th of September and Scotland has decided. The no vote had it. I said it was going to be 60-40 to a no vote. I think the last figures I saw were about 55-45. It was still a pretty decisive margin in an enormous near 90% turnout. So democracy in action in a way that perhaps has not been seen in my lifetime, and fantastic to see. Why do I think it happened? Well, I think the truth is that little phrase, better together, is probably the nub of it. At the end of the day, there were very good reasons for Scotland or Scottish people to think about going independent, but I think the very good reasons for staying part of the United Kingdom just edged it in the end. And that's a good thing. It's good that people have had a chance to make their opinions known. It's good that people have had a chance to say what they think. And now Alex Salmond has accepted the decision of the Scottish people. I think he said for now in his acceptance speech, but we'll wait and see. But that is very good news for the markets. Sterling is back up. The vacillation that we've seen in some of the stock markets is starting to ease. And that's got to be good news for the recovery, because what business hates more than anything else is uncertainty. And now that we have certainty about that, that's very good news indeed. Of course, politically, there's going to be all sorts of challenges over the next few months as the British Parliament tries to work out what devolved powers go to Scotland. That's probably the easy bit. The harder bit is going to be working out how they go to Scotland and how you end up with a separate English Parliament going forward, which could be very interesting indeed. Accountable democracy is a marvellous thing, but the cost of all this bureaucracy and all these different forums for making decisions just adds more layers of government and more layers of cost on hard-working taxpayers. My name is Simon Webster. For my sins, I'm the Managing Director of Facts and Figures. We're Chartered Financial Planners based in Ashford. And I'm very excited because this week we finally launched our new website. I've been talking about it for months and months and months. And on Wednesday, it went live. It's all pretty, new corporate colours and everything. Do please go and check us out. There's a lot of information about the show just starting to go up, and there'll be a lot more in the weeks to come. But that's at www.fffp.co.uk. And if you fancy following us on Twitter, then look for MoneyTalk_Guru. My next job is to get the Money Talk website live. I've got the draft. I've just got to sign off on it and get it sorted out. This week's show, we're going to focus on starting and setting up your own business. Millions of people in this country dream of working for themselves or already do. But sadly, so many businesses don't quite make it for whatever reason. The government keeps telling us that small businesses are the engine of this economy, but doesn't do a huge amount of joined-up thinking in terms of business support, at least according to a lot of business people I've spoken to over the years. So today, what we're going to talk about is how you might set up, what you might do, how you might go about it, and how you might make sure that yours is one of the businesses that succeeds rather than, sadly, one of the many that doesn't quite make it. I think most people, one way or the other, dream of setting up their own business. Some people just prefer the security of showing up for work at 9 o'clock and going home at 5, and it's the boss's problem. And that's great. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But for a lot of others, they look at what their boss is doing and think, I could do this so much better and I wouldn't be so obnoxious to work for. I hope none of my staff think that. But people dream about setting up their own businesses, and some are effectively forced into it by redundancy. They've got a nice secure job at a company, and one day they discover that that job was not so secure. So there are three key questions that you've got to ask yourself before you get into this. What goods or services can I offer through my business? It's a crucial question. What can you bring to the party? The next question that people don't always think through, perhaps as far as they should, is will this make enough money to support my lifestyle? If you're living very cheaply or you're just out of school or you're living from home, then you don't need a huge amount to support your lifestyle. But if you're married with kids or whatever, you've got other financial commitments and responsibilities, then you need to make quite serious money. It's not cheap to live these days, as we all know. So will your goods or services that you're hoping to bring to market actually make any money? And then another crucial question, do I have enough money to support the transition? Because it's very rare for somebody going out into business that immediately starts making a living wage from day one. So as you transition from having a job and having a regular income coming in, how are you going to get to the stage where you can support yourself? And do you have enough money in your bin, as they say, or in the bank to keep things going? Business opportunities abound. It's just that they have not been thought up yet. I'll say that again. Business opportunities abound, but it's just that they've not been thought up yet. Every so often, somebody comes along with a really good business idea, and it's an opportunity to make some proper money, and they just get on with it. Carphone Warehouse, Phones for You, saw the huge popularity of mobile phones, not just at the time when they launched, but the potential in that market, and they set up fantastic business models. The only problem is, Phones for You and indeed Carphone Warehouse's business are predicated on the fact that they're able to get phones and airtime contracts from the big four mobile phone suppliers. And as Phones for You found out only this week, when Vodafone, EE and O2 all refused to renew contracts, you don't get those contracts, you don't have a business anymore. So you need to think through what your business is going to be dependent on. Now, I've seen an awful lot of business ideas over the years. There are people now making proper money out of eBay. They buy stuff wholesale on eBay and they retail it out and they make enough money on the turn, i.e. the difference that they can pay when they buy at wholesale prices between to the money they charge when they sell at retail. So they buy in bulk relatively cheaply and they sell individually more expensively. People are making money on that sort of turn that they're able to support a degree of their lifestyle or all of their lifestyle. eBay's one option. Do you have a skill, be it intellectual through some profession or through a trade? Electrician and plumber always come to mind when we talk about trades, or plasterer perhaps, or decorator. Can you provide some sort of service? Car valeting is one obvious one that comes to mind. You could even make something, but setting up a manufacturing business from scratch requires a degree of capital, so that can be a little bit harder to do from scratch. You could, of course, buy an existing business, which is another option, but again, that involves putting up quite a lot of money, and that's not available to the average person. But it might be worth thinking about. If somebody is already doing what you want to do, what might the opportunity be to buy that person out or buy into their business? Franchises are another opportunity. I'm not a huge fan of franchises because they often want a significant capital contribution day one and a large proportion of your turnover for variable support. It's an interesting one. Some franchises are worth looking at, others not so much. McDonald's is largely a franchise in the UK, and most McDonald's franchise holders in the UK, once they've put in a significant amount of money, actually start to make some. A lot of car main dealerships are franchise operations, but to set up a BMW dealership, the last time I heard it, cost about £5 million to buy in, so perhaps not for everybody. But once you've decided on what your business niche is going to be it trading on eBay or setting yourself up as a plumber or a decorator or providing some sort of service, then you've really got to start stress testing that idea to see whether it will make you the money that you need. Now, there is a very popular, well-worn story told in business support circles about the Harvard Business School. And they did some research back in 1979, I think it was, but it's still relevant. And they actually wrote a book about it, What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School. And in 1979, students were asked, have you set clear written goals for your future and made plans to accomplish them? Only 3% of the graduates had written goals and plans. 13% had goals, but they were not in writing. And a whopping 84% had no specific goals at all. 10 years later, the members of the class were interviewed again, and this is an MBA class, so these are people who are actually serious about business. And again, the findings, while somewhat predictable, were nonetheless astonishing. The 13% of the class who had goals were earning, on average, twice as much as the 84% who had no goals at all. And what about the 3% who had clear written goals? They were earning, on average, 10 times as much as the other 97% put together. That is, in number and money terms, frankly astounding. I remember hearing that when I first started out in business, but it actually underlines just how important it is to write down what you want to achieve and how you're going to achieve it, to have that plan, keep it near you, keep it updated, and keep going forward. So how do you make a plan? Clearly, day one, it's largely all guesswork, but you've got to start somewhere, and you can narrow down your guesswork by doing some research, seriously looking into what the competitors are doing, if you've got any competition, and you probably have, what they're charging, how they're marketing, and things like this. So you can actually start to get a little bit of a feel for what other businesses in your proposed field are going to be doing. Let's start with a target. Perhaps you might call that a goal. We'll go down the Harvard model. Clearly, it's going to be different for everybody, but let's pretend it's, once I'm established, I need my business to earn me £24,000 per annum or £2,000 per month. And let's assume that £2,000 per month is net profit before tax, so it's the equivalent of salary. Now, this is where I just have to spend a couple of minutes just talking about accounting, because there is fundamental misunderstanding in a lot of business people's heads when they start out about the difference between profit and turnover, and indeed between revenue and balance sheet. And all the accountants listening will be rubbing their hands. But the reality of the situation, there's an old saying, turnover is vanity, profit is sanity. So the key question to ask yourself is, if you can go out and sell £100,000 worth of stuff, that sounds like you're doing really, really well. But if you've picked up £90,000 worth of business expenses on the way through, you've just made 10 grand. So your ego feels good, but if your target was 24, you've undershot your profit target, which, let's face it, was the one that counted, by more than 50%. If, on the other hand, you turn over £50,000 and your business expenses are only £26,000, then you've hit your target of £24,000. So your ego may not feel quite as excited because you haven't really turned over as much as the £100,000 example, but your bank balance and your sanity will be widely rewarded because you've hit your financial target, and that's absolutely crucial. Now, turnover is just a number that accountants and business people use to talk about how much stuff or services they've actually sold in a period. So if you sold £100,000 worth of stuff, your turnover is £100,000. It's fairly straightforward. But the profit is what you get to keep of that £100,000 after you've taken off all your various costs and expenses. And we're going to look at how those break down a little bit later. But the key issue is, the profit is the bit that you get to keep, theoretically. Because, of course, the other issue is, if you make profit, you've got to decide whether you're going to take it out of the business and put it in your back pocket, or whether you're going to take that profit and reinvest it in the business in developing your turnover further. People get very aerated about the huge profits that are made by the utility companies. But their profit has to do two things. One, it has to go out to shareholders who invested in the business. They've got capital tied up in the company, so they want to get some income on their capital. That's the dividends that the utility companies pay out. But also, the utilities need to generate profit in order to renew the infrastructure. Most of the utility companies in the UK have got appalling infrastructure. The drains don't work, the water pipes are old and rusty, they're putting new water mains around central London at a multi-million pound cost as we speak, and we've got all these sort of issues with electricity supply, and power stations need replacing. So the electricity companies need to fund that from the profits they make. They're not going to get the money anywhere else. So when you're setting up a business, you've got to decide how much of the profit you're going to keep and how much you're going to reinvest. The other issue is that you might start with £50,000 in cash to put into your business. That's quite a lot of money on day one. But if you've got to buy some stuff to set your business up, be that stock or be that the down payment on a premises or improvements to the premises or sorting out your shop front or buying basic equipment to do your job, whatever it is, that doesn't really impact on your profit because accountants would regard that as a balance sheet transaction, i.e. you've taken your asset of cash and turned it into your asset of plant and machinery or fixtures and fittings. So that money effectively sits in a different silo in accounting terms. What you might do is say, well, some of that stuff is actually going to wear out over a period. You call that depreciation and you put a charge into your profit and loss account for the use of that stuff for a period. So if you had a piece of kit that was going to cost you £10,000, you reckon it was going to last 5 years, you put a charge to profit of £2,000 each year for 5 years, and that would effectively reflect in your costs the depreciation, the wearing out of the asset that you had purchased. In our example, we said we needed to make £2,000 per month net profit before tax to make our new business viable. How long can we afford to take to get there? I.e. how long before our other money, if we have any, actually runs out? Then the key question is, what do we need to do to make that £2,000 a month net profit, and how long do we need to do it? I had a call from a potential client the other day. They were considering the purchase of a £3,000 embroidery machine. They planned to embroider clothing for the country fair, livestock and equine circuit, and anyone else they could think of. I said, great, how many garments do you need to embroider before you make any money? Well, the reply was, well, if I embroider one and charge £10, I've made £10, so that's a start. To which I replied, are you sure? Because it sounds to me like you're still £2,990 behind in cash terms, as well as the cost of getting that business and the cost of material, i.e. thread. And that doesn't factor in your time. Oh, I hadn't thought about that, was the response. Well, of course you haven't. You're all excited about setting up a business. But as your financial advisor, I have to tell you that there is zero point in setting up a commercial business if you can't see how you're going to make money out of it before you start. So in our plan for this fledgling embroidery business, some of the questions that you might need to think about asking are, what exactly are we going to sell? Are we going to sell embroidery on items that people bring into us, or are we going to sell the items and embroider them on a sort of mail order basis? What are our costs going to be? Well, if we buy the stuff in, we're going to have the cost of carrying stock. We're going to have to buy the stock. Then we're going to have to factor in the fact that we're selling that item. Then we're going to have to factor in the fact that we're adding value to that item by putting the embroidery in it. So what do we need to charge in order to cover those costs? And how long will it take to embroider a particular item? Which gives you an idea of your theoretical maximum output. What do I need to factor into my costings for my time in doing the work? Well, the answer may be nothing, because I'm going to live off the profit, or it might be there's going to be two of us, so I've got to factor in some wages. It depends how you're looking at it. And then the really important sanity check, what price will the market stand? In our example, if you need to charge £50 for an embroidered T-shirt and there's a bloke down the road flogging them for £25 because he buys them in from China, there is precious little point in you selling them unless you're really going to be selling on a huge quality markup and say, we use the best T-shirts in the world and our value is phenomenal. It may be expensive, but the quality, they last forever and they look really good. But you've got to understand that that's a very difficult message to get across, and building a premium brand, a luxury brand out of nowhere can sometimes be quite challenging. Next crucial question. How many units do I need to sell in order to hit my profit target? Ouch. That really does focus the mind. Where and how can I sell that many units? Will there be any costs involved in sales? Do I have to charge delivery? How am I going to organise that delivery? How am I going to charge for it? How much impact will that have on my price? Will the market stand that additional price? Am I still likely to be making any money at the end of it? You get the idea. There is a huge, huge, huge amount to think about. Because then you have to think about the not-so-obvious costs. Accountancy, maybe business advice, training, day-to-day maintenance and ultimately replacement of equipment. For example, our £3,000 embroidery machine might have a 5-year life, so you need to allow £600 a year towards buying the next one. You probably need to buy some insurance. If you employ people, you absolutely have to. We've mentioned transportation and marketing, but you also need to consider invoicing and record keeping. How are you going to do it? Perhaps some sort of accounting system. Sage software is quite popular, although quite hard to use. But it's almost essential to have that sort of thing if you're going to register for VAT. And more on that one later. But what's all that software and time actually going to cost the business, and who's going to do it? And having thought all this stuff up, you then need to write it down. This will be particularly essential, if it's possible to be particularly essential, if you need to obtain any seed money or bank finance of some sort. And this, of course, is where a basic knowledge of spreadsheets is essential. You usually set up a business plan and cash flow forecast in a spreadsheet, and if you don't know how to use him, you're going to have to find somebody who does. You might want to start with your kids. Sadly, it does seem that all of them from the age of about 12 have a very good grasp of the IT that I didn't really start to understand until I was about 25. If you haven't got kids that can do it, find a friend and ask them to help you, or buy somebody in. But mapping your income and your expenditure out for the next couple of years is absolutely essential, so you can have some idea of whether your business is actually feasible, and you can actually look on a month-by-month basis and see how close you are to your targets, and then you can start juggling your business plan in line with your actual practical experience. It's also worth bearing in mind that there are tons of business plan templates on the internet. Look for one already out there that looks a bit like your business is going to be. Now, when you start to consider your business costs, you can split them into three categories. But I think when we'll talk about that in a bit more detail after this break.
And I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping, with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way. You're just a step on the boss man's ladder, but you got dreams he'll never take away. On the same boat with a lot of your friends, waiting for the day your ship will come in, and the tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way. Working 9 to 5.
As Dolly fades out, we think how well she did at Glastonbury this year. She sold more albums in the UK, I think, in the 6 months after that than she had done in the previous 10 years. Good for her. Great record. Who wants to be working 9 to 5? Well, that's a very good question. If you work for yourself, you'll probably be working a damn sight longer than that. We said that we'd talk about business costs, three categories. When you're setting up, the first thing that you've got to think about are your setup costs themselves. Now, costs include the acquisition of the embroidery machine in our example. And these days, you can't have a business without a website. You might need to go out day one and buy a van for cash, which makes it set up, or lease it, which makes it a fixed cost. You might need to acquire premises. You might need to do all sorts of things, but there'll be certain initial costs, initial consultation, accountancy advice, business advice, paying your financial advisor, that sort of thing that you need to factor into your setup budget. Beyond that, you then have the fixed costs of running the business on a day-to-day basis. Now, the fixed costs of running the business on a day-to-day basis are often premises related. If you need to have business premises, then you need to go to pay rent. You might need to pay rates, although the good thing is if you've got small business rate relief, you're not paying anything until March 2015. Thank you, George Osborne. I was trying to think who's the Chancellor, but thank you, George Osborne. Long may it continue. Business rates are a huge tax on small business, and we don't like paying them, not least because we don't feel we get very much for them. You might have van costs, wages, insurance, depreciation on kit that we talked about earlier on. You might have marketing, which might be a fixed cost early on as you buy in. It might be a setup cost, particularly early on when you actually have to pay out for a lot of marketing. But either way, you've got to start thinking, factoring these things in. The last section under costs is variable costs. And these are the costs for the things that you only spend money on when you make stuff or actually provide your service. In our embroidery business, the only variable costs might be thread, machine maintenance, delivery, and if we actually start employing people to actually make the stuff, then the wages for those people that are making the stuff. I know I'm only really scratching the surface here, but you get the idea. What about becoming a service provider? Let's say you're trained as an electrician and you want to go out on your own. The biggest single issue for you, and indeed for the embroidery business, is where am I going to get my business from? Now, there's a number of headings that you can put under your marketing plan. But the obvious and first one, and we've mentioned it already, is a website. Now, there's your own website as a business. A small fledgling business might just set up a little brochure website. Might cost less than £500. Put up 4 or 5 pages, something like that, just to say who you are, what you do, a little bit about you. Something that looks vaguely professional is very useful because people will use that to judge you. If you have a cheap business website with poor graphics and spelling mistakes that looks a bit tacky and out of date, that doesn't work well on phones or tablets, then people are going to judge you by the way they judge your website. So if your website is good, you get a tick in the box. If your website is bad, they'll probably go on to the next one and they'll think your work will be like your website. Bear that in mind. It applies to all the marketing collateral you put out there. Other web opportunities might be for the electrician, trust a trader, for all businesses, various forms of business directory, and you might find some specialist websites that you can link up to or advertise on. I've said the word advertising, so we've got to consider local newspaper advertising. There's a lot of business, local business directories of one sort or another, and a number of tradespeople swear by them. I'm not sure how effective it would be for our embroidery business, but they might do better thinking about county show programs. That might be a way for them to generate business in their opportunity in their particular line. But you've got to think about this and think where you're going to spend your marketing money to get a halfway reasonable return. But do watch out. There are some fraudsters out there that are selling huge promises of marketing success to business people, and you can get very badly stung. And it's one of my particular hobby horses that when you are trading as an individual and doing business with businesses, there is a lot of business-to-consumer protection out there. If a business rips you off as a consumer, there are a huge pile of people from trading standards onwards who will help you out. Once you put on your businessman hat and you do business with other businesses, then you're in the situation where you're expected to be sufficiently intelligent and sufficiently knowledgeable about business that you can make your own decisions, and you pay the price for your own mistakes. And you will find, perhaps to your surprise, that there is a lot less protection in the business-to-business environment than there is in the business-to-consumer environment. And if you're just making your first step from B2C and going into B2B, then be on your guard. It is a real minefield out there. So look very carefully before you sign any contracts. Get a friend, or preferably a lawyer or accountant or financial advisor or a business person that you know, to review this stuff. And don't ever, ever, ever get pressured into somebody saying to you, well, if you make a decision today by 3 o'clock, you're going to get this wonderful, wonderful discount. If it's that good, it'll still be there tomorrow. Most of these things are some form of scam, some way of trying to trick the unwary out of their hard-earned cash. So just don't go for it. Yeah, going back to our electrician and how he might get his business, the various professional connections. You might get overflow from other established tradesmen. You might get builders or developers or estate agents that are prepared to put work your way. But you need to actually make some sort of, you need to make some sort of arrangement with the developer or whoever to see if you can actually get yourself sorted out with them. Then there's word of mouth. You've got to actually find out what you're actually doing, what you can actually do to get the word of your business out there. And that's always a challenge. You can also consider trying to get referrals from your existing clients. Networking is always a very good means of generating new business. There are a number of these organizations that exist. Some might say far too many, but the local Chamber of Commerce probably has something, and that's probably free to chamber members and relatively inexpensive if you're not a member. And then there's other organizations that have been around for years, like BNI. I played with that for nearly 10 years, and we built a very successful business out of BNI over a number of years, which was extremely helpful. And then you, dare I say it, there's even cold calling and pre-approach letters and stuff like that. You can also think about leaflet drops, just getting your name out there, thinking about where you might get people who are going to give you work. That's what it's all about, and you've got to really give that some thought. Just being good at your trade is not a guarantee that you're going to get any immediate money. It just won't necessarily happen like that. And this is where you have to make one of your first big business decisions. You're going into business because you can do the job. If you're an embroiderer, because you can do embroidery. If you're an electrician, because you can work the tools and do the electrical installs. But where are you going to find the time to do all this marketing? Can you afford to get someone else to do it for you? And the key question for anyone self-employed is, will the person I hire do it as well as I could do it myself? Possibly not, but would it be good enough? And if we're talking about an electrician doing marketing, the chances are the marketing person will be better at marketing than the electrician. But you've really got to look this through. Getting that balance right is a crucial issue when you start in business. You usually have one great month for business acquisition, which fills your diary for the next month. So you then work flat out doing the actual work, and you arrive in month 3 with nothing to do. So you have to start the marketing again, and you've had another month where you've made no money. So what you need to do is set up a business development entry or entries in your diary, so you do business development work every week and you always try to have a decent pipeline of future work. It's worth underlining, and I do underline this because I know a number of tradesmen who are not very good at this, you need to find time to do the invoicing, credit control and purchase of the stuff you actually need to do the job. For our electrician, that might be cables, switches, parts, other bits and pieces. But quite often, I instruct a tradesman to do some work for me, and I don't see the bill for 2 months because he's been too busy to get sorted out. Now, that's not very good for his cash flow and not very good for his business. So it might be worth talking to your partner, be that wife, husband, boyfriend, girlfriend, good friend or whoever, and ask them if they would give a couple of hours a week to just take your diary and turn that into invoices for you and record them properly so you've got some chance of getting your money in. There's no point in doing the work if you don't actually get paid for doing it. So once you have written a business plan, this is how much I'm going to sell and when, and this is what I'm going to charge for it, and a marketing plan, this is what I'm going to do to get that level of business in, you can then start considering your business structure, because there are choices as to how you actually set your business up. Do you want to be self-employed? If there's more than one of you, you could form a partnership. And bear in mind that if you are working carrying on a business in common with a view to profit, as the Partnership Act of 1890 would have you have it said, then you are deemed to be in a partnership. And if you don't have a written partnership agreement, then the Partnership Act applies and it may not give you the results you want. So you've got to think about this business structure business quite carefully. Self-employed, partnership, limited liability partnership. Ooh, that's a relatively new one. Not many people know about that one. Or a limited company. Now, the key issues really for which business structure you consider probably concern costs, liability, confidentiality, and tax. If you're a one-man band setting yourself up and you're only going to make about £20,000 in the first year net, then almost certainly self-employed would be the best route for you. I say that because you don't have to pay an accountant. There may be some marginal tax savings by drawing dividends out of the business rather than taking your income as net profit, but it doesn't alter the fact that you've actually got to jump through quite a lot of hoops as a limited company director. You've got to report to the revenue, you've got to file accounts, you've got to employ an accountant. Well, you don't have to, but you'd be very wise to. You've got to fill in a corporation tax return, which I've just done recently for one of my daughter's businesses, and it was a nightmare, not something I would recommend to anybody. And you have a lot of hoops to jump through for relatively modest savings. So you're probably better off being self-employed, at least initially. But there's liability issues as well. One of the things that you need to remember as a self-employed businessman is if your business screws up, you are personally liable. And you're not just liable for the money you got tied up in the business, you are liable for every penny that you have from the house that you live in to the shirt on your back. So if you have a claim go against you badly, you can end up very, very, very seriously out of pocket. Now, this is why businesses buy insurance, and we'll talk about insurance a bit later. But it doesn't alter the fact that if it all goes horribly wrong, then you could be personally liable. If, on the other hand, you set up a limited company and you just put a pound into that limited company, and we haven't got enough time to talk about how you set a company up, other than you can buy one on the internet for 30 quid, your liability is limited to the share value of that company. And if you've just put a pound in, that's it. You have no other personal liability unless you are trading improperly. There are a few caveats with this. But in the main, if you do it properly, your liability is limited, which it is why it is worth seriously considering setting yourself up as a limited liability company. If you're going to owe substantial money, or you're going to get into big contracts where you might get sued, or there might be some issue that you could get pinged for in the rugby parlance because you've created a problem and somebody's going to sue you. Limited liability partnerships can be very attractive for tax purposes, but that's a little bit outside the startup debate, so I'm not going to go spend any time on that. Another thing to consider, however, is confidentiality. Limited companies have to file accounts, and then people can see how you're doing and what your business is worth. Sole traderships and partnerships don't. So there is that one to bear in mind, although in truth, the limited filing that you have to do for a limited company makes the confidentiality issue not quite as big as it might be. So we talked about business structure, and I suppose I've got to spend a minute on VAT, value-added tax, much beloved of us all, not. Once you have registered for VAT, you have to charge it to all your customers. That effectively makes you 20% more expensive to domestic customers who can't get the VAT back, but makes no difference to VAT registered business customers who can. So if you're primarily B2B, the extra cost argument doesn't really apply, but you've still got to do the accounting bit. But if you're nearly all B2C, then try and keep yourself under the £81,000 VAT registration threshold, because once you pass it, you've then got to start charging VAT to your customers. In fact, if you turn over £81,000 in the last 12 months, you must register for VAT immediately. If you turn over less, you can voluntarily register, and you might want to, because then, if you buy a load of stuff to set your business up, and you've paid VAT on it, you can get it back. In fact, in some circumstances, you can even go back 4 years to reclaim VAT you've paid while setting up your business. It's worth looking at. VAT is a real issue because you've got to make returns 4 times a year, and you've got to carry the VAT that you've collected in your bank account and remember not to spend it, because every quarter you've got to write a cheque to HMRC for the VAT. And sometimes businesses forget that and they get a horrible shock when the VAT due date comes up, and they haven't kept enough money in reserve. So there's a lot of fiscal discipline involved in setting up your own business and making sure that you run it properly. Next heading, raising finance. Now, if you're lucky and you're setting yourself up as an electrician, you might just need a few decent tools, which you'll have, and a little bit of stock, which you might be able to fund out of what we'll call working capital, personal working capital. If, on the other hand, you're going to set yourself up in an embroidery business and you haven't got a lot of money, then you might need to fund the purchase of your £3,000 embroidery machine or something rather larger. And if you've got to start taking on premises and leases and other stuff, you might need £10,000, £20,000, £30,000. So where are you going to get that money from? Well, one of the places to consider is there are a variety of government schemes out there. And if you Google government finance, I got a number of hits straight off where there were some suggestions. Got to jump through an awful lot of hoops for government schemes, but if you happen to be landing on the right day when somebody's got some budget left, it can't be helpful to get that. Another one to consider that's a little bit out of left field is crowdfunding. It's becoming increasingly popular. There's an organisation out there called Funding Circle where people put up 50 quid, 1,000 quid, 10,000 pounds, 50,000 pounds, and they buy in to certain business propositions. So they just lend a relatively modest amount of money into a portfolio of loans. That minimises their risk, but they'll be charging you 5, 6, 7%, and that means they're getting a lot better return than they would have got from cash at a bank or a building society. And they're having a bit of fun and acting like a business angel, which can be worth doing. You can also talk to friends and family. A lot of people don't like doing that, but it's worth bearing in mind, family members will often be prepared to bail you out in the right circumstances. So it's worth bearing in mind. But all funders will look to see how invested you are personally in the business. The more money you put in yourself, the more other people will see you as invested in the business and the more enthusiastic they will be about helping you out. I haven't mentioned banks yet. Well, we always try and keep that one down a bit. I actually had my bank manager on the phone the other day being very friendly and very pleasant, which was really nice. But we've actually got some money in the bank and the business has been doing very well for the last few years and we don't need any more money. But it's still worth considering banks. When we bought our building, our bank, and I'll give them a name check, NatWest, surprised me by how ready, willing and able they were to give us a not insignificant amount of money to purchase our building. It was all down to the fact, however, that we did have a very strong business plan, we had some sensible suggestions about how we were going to fund it, and we put in 25% of the cost of the building from our own resources, and then the directors guaranteed it. But it doesn't alter the fact that if you come up with a sensible plan, banks are quite often willing to play. They are less willing to fund startups where you're saying, well, I need £50,000 just as sort of working capital to fund cash flow. The banks are usually much more interested in funding asset purchase. I mentioned deciding on a business structure earlier. Now we have our idea, our business and our marketing plan and our money. We need to set up our trading vehicle. First off, if you go self-employed, you must register with HMRC straight away. It says on the HMRC website, at the earliest opportunity, and from the time you register as self-employed, you've got to start paying your weekly national insurance stamp, and I think it's about £2.75 or something. I forget exactly what it is. It's not a huge amount of money, but you've got to pay it every week, whether you make a profit or not. Very important, don't forget. They get cross if you don't register. Funny that. You might decide that you want to set up a limited company, and that's not unusual. In fact, remarkably easy to do. You just go Google company formation, and you'll find half a dozen listings on the first page who are offering to set you a company up off the shelf for about 30 quid, and they'll send you all the paperwork that you need, and you can fill in a simple form online and do it in about 15 minutes and just pay out 30 quid. Really, really easy, surprisingly so. Once you've formed your company, you then need to take your certificate of incorporation to the bank and get them to set you up a company bank account, but that's the next stage in the process. You could set up a limited liability partnership, but as I said, that's a slightly more complicated thing to start thinking about. If you are going to trade as a partnership, however, setting up as an LLP would probably be preferable. But you've really got to take some serious accounting advice as to whether limited liability company or limited liability partnership or indeed partnership is going to be the most appropriate one for you. But here a massive double red underlined point. So often friends get into business together through accident. It just happens. They're jogging along one day and they say, hey, what about us going into business selling widgets? We could do so much better than this horrible boss that we're working for. And they go off and they do it and they start running it. It works really well for 5 or 6 years and they're making money and everything's wonderful. And then a wheel comes off. One of them gets divorced. One of them gets sick. One of them falls out with the other. One of them starts having an affair with the other one's wife or business partner or whatever it is. And it then starts to become an absolute nightmare. And if there is no written agreement in place, then it can be horrendously, horrendously messy. If you are a limited company, that sort of thing to some degree is taken care of, but you've got to argue about who's going to own the business and who's going to own the shares. But that's what you're arguing about. If there is no written partnership agreement, the Partnership Act provisions of 1890 apply, and as they're over 120 or 130 years old, that starts to get a little bit convoluted. So strongly, strongly, strongly recommend, couldn't recommend it highly enough, get yourself a written partnership agreement in any and all circumstances. I've mentioned some of the things that new business owners have to consider in terms of insurance and stuff, and we'll come back to that after this break.
Temp Network have hundreds of vacancies across West Kent. We offer ongoing work, weekly pay, and a variety of shift patterns to suit your needs. Visit us at www.tempnetwork.co.uk or call Tunbridge Wells 531-777.
Let's work it to the bone, bone, bone. Come on, work.
So we worked 9 till 5, we've been stuck in a chain gang, and as the dulcet tones of Chrissie Hynde fade away, we've got to start thinking seriously about what insurance do we need to put in place for our small business. And there's a fair bit to think about. One off, if you are going to set yourself up as anybody's going to have anything to do with the public, it is a legal requirement that you have public liability insurance. You must have this. It's the law. If you employ anybody, you've also got to have employer's liability insurance, and you must have that. It's also the law. Now, between the two of them, it's only going to cost you a couple of hundred quid a year, so it's not necessarily a fortune, but it's something to factor in, and you've got to deal with it. Just phone any local broker or Google it, and you'll get a plethora of offerings. There's a word, a plethora of offerings. That's actually a phrase rather than a word, but you know what I mean. Professional indemnity insurance is really important if you are going to consider a career as a financial advisor, accountant, lawyer, or anybody else that's going to be dealing with professional services. You might also want to consider director's insurance if you're going to be a director of a company. You can get yourself into all sorts of legal trouble if you don't follow your obligations correctly, and this can lead to fines and fees and costs and other stuff. So director's insurance to protect you is probably worth thinking about, but that's not so cheap. If you're going to have any form of business premises, you need to think about buildings insurance, and if you're going to put stuff in that premises, you're going to need contents insurance. If you're just going to have tools on your wagon, as the saying goes, then you want to find out whether your personal contents insurance covers it for business use, and the chances are it probably doesn't, which might mean you need to start thinking about specialist insurance, because a lot of tradespeople have got a couple of £1,000 worth of tools on their vehicle, and if that gets nicked or the van gets broken into, then they haven't got a business and they haven't got the £2,000 to go out there and get it sorted out. It's also quite important to think about what type of motor insurance you have, because if you've just got social, domestic and pleasure cover on your policy, and by the way, that's what 99.9% of the population actually has, then you will not be insured if you are driving your vehicle for work. So find out whether your vehicle insurance covers you for using your vehicle for business purposes. It may have been perfectly fine under your existing insurance policy to use your van to drive to and from your employer's work and then go to bits of work that he sent you to, but as soon as you start working on your own account, you're no longer driving to and from work. It's a subtle difference, but it's important, and if the insurance company finds out when you have a claim, they may not pay out, and that can be awfully expensive. It's also possible as a business to get legal expenses insurance, which if you get sued is awfully helpful, and it might be worth thinking about. So with any of the policies that you've purchased that we talked about earlier, then think about getting that bolted on, because legal expenses insurance is often available for business people as a bolt-on extra. Now, we've talked about the fact that you can set yourself up as a limited company, as a sole trader, or as a partnership, but it's worth thinking about what happens to the business if you get sick, or if you get, if you become dead, basically, if you die. What happens if you die? What happens if you get sick? What happens to the business? What happens to the money that's tied up in that business? What happens to its goodwill and its client list? And if you've got any business partners, how are they impacted? And these are not nice questions. Nobody ever wants to think about them. But in fact, it's always a good idea to look at, when you walk into a room, it's always a good idea to make sure there's where the door is. Is that, is the one you've come in the only way in or out, or is there another exit? And it applies in business all the time. Don't get into anything unless you know the way out. Applies to contracts that you sign. Every time you see you sign a contract, first question, how much is it going to get, how much is it going to cost me to get out of this if I don't like it? And it's a really, really important question. We've just found out that we've got to give 6 months' notice on some software. Fortunately, not very much money, so I'm not unduly upset, although I'm cross with myself that I missed it. But I've got to pay these perishing people 6 months' license fees for software we never even used. And it's made me very, very cross. So you've got to look and see what the exit room is. It's very easy to make mistakes on the hop. If you are a partner of somebody else in business, then if you're a limited company, you want to look at director share purchase assurance. And if you're trading as a partner in a partnership as a partner, then you want partnership assurance. And those two types of insurance enable your estate to have enough money to buy out your deceased partner's interest from the business. And it's really, really important that you set that up. So your surviving business partner gets a wad of cash and he can give it to your family for the share in the business. Very important. Another thing to think about is if you are now self-employed or running your own business, what happens to your income if you're sick? Normally, it stops. Now, if you're a bit poor at invoicing or your credit control's not all that good, you might have a month or two's money in the pipe, but what happens after that? It's seriously worth considering permanent health insurance that will pay out a regular monthly income if you are unable to work through illness or injury until you get better, until you die, or until you reach the expiry date of the policy. Permanent health insurance is an absolute essential for all self-employed people, and you must get it. And if you haven't talked to an independent financial advisor, have a look at Facts and Figures website, www.fffp.co.uk, and just look around the site till you find the permanent health insurance section. There is one there. It doesn't need to be a huge amount of money, but if you don't have it, boy, will you regret it if there's a problem. Another one to think about is private medical insurance. We're talking about a lot of insurances, but the truth is, if you are self-employed, there will be convenient times to go to hospital and inconvenient times to go to hospital. If you work for yourself and you've got a bad leg or a bad knee and you need a knee operation, having to wait 6 months to get that operation when you can't work is going to hit your income for 6 months. Far, far better to have private medical insurance and be able to get in straight away without waiting and get it sorted out. Last one under business insurance is key man insurance. If your business is a bit larger and you have key employees in that company and they become sick or disabled or die, what happens to the business's profit in those circumstances? And the key man insurance would effectively pay money to the company if you lose that key person through one of those causes. Now, we've talked about the insurances, but there are some business benefits. We talk about pensions quite a lot, but it's really so, so, so important. The money you make today serves two purposes, perhaps three. One, to provide you with income today. Two, you need to put away money for tomorrow, when you retire. And three, and I did say three, perhaps a capital value for your business. If you could sell your business and take a wad of cash out on the way through, that would be really rather nice. So three purposes to working, and you've got to try and get yourself organized to make that happen. Income, capital value, and put some money aside, preferably out of the business because it's an allowable pension contributions are an allowable expense for business purposes and don't qualify for national insurance. So on the whole, it's the best way of getting money out of a company, and it's a very good way of reducing your tax bill if you're self-employed. Either way, you've got to get yourself sorted out. So there's just a few of the things to consider in an hour that you need to think about when you're running your own business and setting it up for the first time. There are a huge range of issues. You have to be an expert in your particular trade. You need to become expert in marketing. You need to become expert in accountancy and bookkeeping. You need to become expert in trading and dealing with awkward customers and just getting yourself sorted out generally. You need to become a master of time control, because the biggest problem for a lot of people with their own businesses is finding the time to do all the stuff that they need to do. I know waiting for me back at the office at this moment is a pile of paper nearly 18 inches high. And it is scary. It sits there a lot. And when you work in a service industry, if you can't provide the service because you're snowed under doing other stuff, business reputation suffers. So it's always that balancing act. So if you can't be that expert yourself, you actually need to think about buying those expertise in. I like to think I'm halfway decent at marketing for our business, but I've got a meeting with a marketing company on Monday of next week, and they are presenting our next generation marketing plan to take us forward for the next 12 months. They're going to charge us quite a lot of money for that, but I hope that that is going to set the business into a very good place going forward into the future. So you've got to know what you're good at, you've got to know what you're bad at, and you've got to know that there's only one of you, and you've got to focus on the things that make you money, not on the things that you think are important. You've got to think about how you get the money in and try and delegate everything else wherever possible. If you do that, if you have made a plan, if you run the plan, if you do the marketing, then you will find that your business is a success. And it'll be a success because you worked hard, you wrote it down, you looked at your plan, you kept it under review, and you just kept going. So many people try something for 5 minutes, find it doesn't work, and stops. The reality of the situation is the people who become successes tried it for a bit, found it didn't work, and then tried harder for longer. And lo and behold, they became successful. And on that happy note, I will love you and leave you. This is Simon Webster, the Money Talk Guru, signing off for another week. Check out the Facts and Figures website, www.triple.